Well, once again, it's my great pleasure to welcome Dan Renshaw into the studio. Welcome, Dan.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate the return.
Okay. Well, in our first in the series of interviews, we talked somewhat about the history, kind of an overview. And as we go along, what we plan to do is to look at some very specific instances of people, places, and things. But what I'm picking up on is that perhaps a listener, particularly a listener who has some familiarity with Hatcher Pass, would wonder how it is that you can live up there, and is it really true that you're the highest, how can we place this?
Highest permanent resident.
Highest permanent resident in Alaska. Let's talk about that as a kickoff to this whole discussion. You're up there. Many people know where Independence Mine is. And then beyond that, so if you go to Independence Mine, how do you get to your place?
Just straight up the hill, up the valley floor. It takes you to the Goldcorp Mine. It's contiguous to the Independence property.
Okay. So. And once upon a time, not so long ago, a lady came up because she was a census taker. Is that correct?
Yes. I think the proper term is supernumerator.
Okay.
Excuse me. And she postholed her way up one spring day, and we sat there on the porch, and she made mention of that she thought in all of her reading of the census and so on and the work she had done, that here I was at the highest elevation. And you know, 4,000 feet, that seems very improbable, but when you think about where people live in Alaska, it's mainly coastal,
right?
River valleys. Mm-hmm. There's a few people in high passes on roads, but they're not that high.
Right. And to be a permanent resident, what does that take? What did that take to make it possible for you to live up there most of the time, coming down as you have today and other times? You're not a hermit so much as you've chosen to have a house there.
The camp has been there, Mike, for a long time. A very nice camp built in the late 30s.
Right.
At that time, it had running water, it had electricity. It was appended to the milling operation. Nicely done cabin. I have had to do a lot of work over the years to keep it, mainly the foundation, roof, that kind of thing. But very comfortable. Oftentimes, in the winter months, I'm inverted by as much as 30 degrees. It's very nice, very warm, when you might be suffering down here in 10 below.
Oh, okay. We have experienced that temperature inversion, which people have talked about. And at other times, are you then colder than we are here?
This summer. I oftentimes look underneath a cloud bank that's just high enough to let me see the valley where it's sunshining down there, and it's raining on me, and sometimes it can snow any day of the year.
Okay.
And sometimes does in the middle of summer, and that's the downside.
Okay. So let's talk. You've nicely described, you had an older cabin, which apparently was reasonably well built because it survived with your attention to this point. And you also have water up there.
Running water, a water system that has quite a story to it that I won't burden you with right now. We could come back to that another day. But water from the creek, which you might frown upon, but we've never been able to identify any illness or anything related to it. And, it's very good water. We really enjoy it.
Okay. So in terms of that other utility that many people find useful, power, electricity, how's that work for you?
excuse me. When the mill was running, when the mine was operable back in the 30s and 40s, there was The whole camp was electrified by the generator that ran the various pieces of equipment in the mill.
Okay.
So there was everything, or the buildings were all created with an electrical system with the fuse boxes, the whole works. Very nice. Today, I have a solar collector and a couple of large 6-volt batteries that most days is adequate to give me power in the morning hours, in the winter. In the evening, I run a small generator.
Okay, so you're speaking my language. We have 9 solar panels on our home down here in Palmer. But, of course, we're also connected to the grid. And so we have the best of all worlds in one sense, I suppose. How long have you had the solar panels up there?
Oh, gosh, of various configurations, 6 years, 7 years.
Okay. So given the summer sunlight that is up there, I would expect easily produce, unless you have some strange appliances that are drawing a lot of power, you easily produce enough there.
Yeah, the summer, starting in March, usually from March till this time right now, I've just started using the generator. It's all free. It's all solar collection.
Okay.
Winter months, on the shortest day of the year, if we have clear weather, it's amazing how, especially at lower temperatures, how efficient that solar collector is. It's facing right into the sun. I'm also getting reflection.
Right.
And lower temperatures actually increases the efficiency. So it works well. It works amazingly well.
Now, have you ever thought of or worked with a wind power generator?
Pretty inconsistent up there. I've thought about it. The solar arrangement I have now works very well. I can't imagine a big enough marginal increase with solar to make it worthwhile.
Okay. And, of course, there's the third possibility, hydro.
Hydro, in the middle of winter, that's our big problem. All of our water sources are pretty well dried up.
Okay, so they don't flow underneath there.
Well, our water system that's in the creek, we actually have a spring that feeds the creek, and then we collect the water in an intake dam, a structure we built to keep snow from complicating the freezing of the pond inside of the dam. We struggle to make sure we get all of that because it's just enough to keep the water system going. So hydro in the winter when you needed it, it just isn't.
That's not going to be.
It's just not there.
So that leaves the picture for listeners of a cabin with electricity and water. Heat. How do you heat the place?
This cabin was well built, but when it was built in the late 30s, in the late 30s, insulation was an incidental. Fuel was so inexpensive that it was much cheaper to burn the fuel than to buy the insulation. Wow. And insulation was poor quality. It was sawdust. It was newspaper. It was, you know, miscellaneous. They hadn't invented fiberglass or any of the current things. So it's an uninsulated building. I bank it up with snow. My north wall, which is the most critical, is quickly covered.
Right.
The south wall, I've gone to extremes to put a veneer of a plastic insulation over it to try to cut down on some of the wind blowing through. But on a normal, calm, cool day, I've got the stove on low. It's amazing. An old stove, it's a range, built in the 30s. I put a new fire pot in it that has a catalytic converter, and it is amazing, Mike, to see the efficiency. The old stove, its primary claim to fame was making soot.
Oh, okay.
The new stove, when I go to clean it once a year, I might get a half a cup of granular stuff. It's just amazing. I'm probably getting 80% efficiency out of the fuel.
Well, that's pretty amazing.
So that translates into my fuel oil bill for the whole season, the whole winter and summer combined, being around 700 gallons.
Okay. And you do burn a fuel oil?
Fuel oil, yeah.
Okay.
Right. And delivered as an annual fall event, yeah.
Okay. Well, let's see now. In the fall, before the fall of snow, access to your cabin is by vehicle. You can actually drive up there, or how does that work?
Yes, the old road system. The road system that is there on the Goldcord property, the Goldcord mine property, was built in probably about 1918 and built by an investor promoter.
Okay.
He incorporated his purchase and was selling stock, and he needed a good road to get people in to look at this. And he was so he built a really nice road.
Oh,
very nice. It has a lot of switchbacks in it to get up to my cabin, but very useful today. Well, not today. Today I'm snowed out.
Okay. So this year, my understanding is that you've had a rather significant snowfall, maybe reminiscent of days past, and quite a bit more than last year. Is that correct?
Exactly, Mike. Gosh, the last several years have been very difficult years. Difficult meaning that everybody wants the snow for recreating. I need it for insulation for my water system. Three years ago, it froze and broke so badly I had to give up. I wasn't going to spend the winter there melting snow. It wasn't worth it.
Okay.
So I did some traveling that particular winter. Last winter was difficult. We finally got enough snow to keep the whole thing from freezing, but you just hate it when day by day like that, you're wondering if you're going to have running water or not. But the snowfall that came three or four days ago, the last storm, was very significant. It was snowing an inch an hour, really accumulating, and did that over a long enough period of time that I've got a snow gauge, and it made it to 40 inches. Today, after a couple of days of wonderful sunshine up there, clear skies, it's settled to about 35.
Oh, but still a mere 35 inches of snow. And yeah. The air temperature up there, it's been warmer?
It's been very warm. My outside thermometer is suspect because of a lot of reflection, but my high yesterday was 68, and it felt like it. It was just a simple shirt outside working. Very nice, very warm, wonderful. Reminiscent of March, you know.
Sure, with those beautiful blue skies.
Right.
Days, making it happen. Well, that area up there above Hatcher Pass, would you say it gets more snow than the area down below, right in Independence Mine area or the bowl below?
It's amazing to see the difference. Hap Wurlitzer down at the Hatcher Pass Lodge, he gets about half of what Independence gets, and early snowfalls,
sure.
And I get about twice as much as the Independence. So it's just in that short little distance, there's quite a variable.
Now I am remembering back when the U.S. Olympic team used to come up and train up there because it had some of, as I remember, the earliest available good snow for training.
True. And even today, the snow that we get whenever it comes, it's usually the earliest in the local area for cross-country skiing.
Okay. That track, I remember going up and skiing on it. Is that off of your property or where was that area located?
It was mainly on Independence property, but it also, there was a couple of different tracks that came onto Goldcord property too.
Okay.
Yeah. Yesterday, looking out my window late, I noticed Ed Strabel doing some grooming down below. So Ed is hard at it, folks, yeah.
Okay, and Ed and I have met Ed I can remember one time late in the evening when I was able to get up there. My wife and I were going up, and we were going up the road from the closed gate up toward Independence Mine, skiing up. And coming down was this figure with a dog, and who? Well, it was Ed. He had gone up there, and there was literally no one else on the mountain. But I'm guessing that he is just up there because there still isn't snow at South Government Peak.
Right. You know, he's in the perfect place for later, where he'll groom trails right from his backyard. But right now, he must have been a little disappointed. DOT, for reasons that weren't obvious, has actually opened the road all the way up to the Independence Mine. Mm-hmm. Probably on request of the parks people needing to do something further at the Independence Mine camp this winter. Well, that ruined the major part of what he would normally be grooming, the road itself.
Right.
So he was grooming from the Gold Court Gate on uphill.
Okay. And as I remember that road, it gets pretty drifted over, so DOT would probably not be able to open it up later in the season.
They choose not to. Yeah, it's there's really no reason to open the gate beyond the end of normal road maintenance at the gate near the Hatcher Pass Lodge. There's a caretaker this year. His name's Bernard. Really nice guy. I'm sure glad he's there. And me, and that's it. And occasionally the Trimbles, who have the A-frame on Gold Court property just beyond, further uphill from me.
Okay, and of course, Hap down at the A-frame down below.
And Hap is down on the other side of the gate show. Yeah, so there's really no need. I prefer to ski in. Prefer because I really revel in the exercise. It takes about 40 minutes. It's not a burden.
Okay, but sometimes do you resort to snowshoes?
Most recently, that's been a necessity. This snow that fell, I'm not a good enough skier to handle skiing on bubblegum. Yeah, it's really tough stuff.
That makes a difference. And also, even if I have to work a bit going up with skis, there's always the other way where skiing tends to be a little bit easier. I've not yet learned how to go quickly down on snowshoes.
They're getting to the point, Mike, where you really should try some of the short, fat skis with skins, and you'd find they're essentially snowshoes, and when you strip the skins, then you can get a little bit of glide out of it, too. I commend it to you, anyway.
Right. So the other gate that tends to be locked up in that area is the gate to the road over Hatcher Pass itself. And that has been closed already? Has that happened?
A lot of construction work. I marvel in this day of shrinking budgets, that the DOT has had in the pipeline funding for an amazing amount of really nice work that they did on the Archangel Road, and then later after that switched over and had a contractor doing a lot of work on the road up Hatcher's Pass. A big improvement. But that it's been closed partly for that reason. And right now it needs to be closed because there's 40 inches of snow up there too.
Right. Now, so far we have been talking about human-powered travel and skis and snowshoes and the rest. What about motorized snow machines? What do they do during the winter? Is there an area there that you find people snow machine on, or do you use the snow machine at all?
I very little. I broke my leg skiing here a few years ago and had to revert to a snow machine.
Okay.
To keep staying there. But some friends made me crutches with snowshoes at the bottom.
Oh.
So I could get around, but I still use the snow. Anyway, the Hatcher Pass management plan done by the government has put a great effort into trying to find a compatible way between all of the mixtures of uses. Mm-hmm. Those who prefer cross-country skiing don't want to have to fight a snow machine on for a trail and so on, and vice versa.
Sure.
So generally speaking, the valley that contains the Independence Mine Historic Park has pretty much now, you'd call it historically, been given over to cross-country skiing for and snowshoeing.
All right.
Do not allow the, there are signs prohibiting the use of snow machines in that valley. But other than that, there's most of the area is open for snow machines. And in the summer months for a lot of four-wheel ATV traffic.
Okay. Okay. So we haven't talked yet about that other modern boon to people, and that is telecommunications using phones. You have phone service there.
Oh, very good phone service, yeah. Excuse me again. I just got a dumb phone with that's a debit thing.
Oh, okay.
And so it uses any signal that's available, and it's a rare thing. I don't have a good signal from my cabin. I can see several towers with binoculars, so I've got line of sight, even though I'm a long ways away.
So this this provides you with a cell service from your cabin?
Yes.
Yeah. And what about computer connections, internet of any sort?
I'm on the internet by way of AT&T, 3 gigs a month.
Oh.
With an iPad, and I'm... it sounds wonderful, but I'm really poor at doing it, but it gets me by. I find out what I need to know.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Okay, so you're in this remote place with a neighbor or two, and you enjoy all that that provides, but you can reach out and look at the rest of the world as well.
Oh, I'm at my elevation. It's really fabulous. This morning... a beautiful, beautiful morning, Mike. I stood out on the deck of my cabin early before there was any light, and the moon is a decrescent, and it was hanging, it looked like suspended directly over the valley by artificial means.
Uh-huh.
And there was Venus, and there was another planet that I can't name, and a beautiful blue sky full of stars. And down in the valley, earlier during the night, you had been in fog down here.
I remember it well, yes.
Oh, man. And I, in the middle of the night, the obligatory trip or two in the middle of the night, you look out the window and see what's going on. But the fog had lifted, and the glow of the lights in Palmer is very reminiscent of the embers of a camp fire. You can, if you want to sit down and write some poetry, it's a beautiful setting to do so.
So looking down is one thing, and then, of course, there's the option of looking up and seeing the Northern Lights.
Sometimes precluded because of the proximity of the mountains to the north.
Okay.
There's a glow, but I'm missing, you know, the show.
Okay.
Occasionally, they come far enough south that I can have an east view that is very, very favorable. I can look out my view window from inside the cabin and watch the display. It's quite nice.
Okay. Mike Malevsky here at Radio Free Palmer, and we've been talking with Dan Renshaw as he's been describing his situation up above Independence Mine. And this is part of a series ongoing of discussions about the history and times of Hatcher Pass. Dan, we're about to finish up here. Any last comments for this session?
on the themes that we've been following, I think not. It's kind of, what would I say, a little bit difficult to talk about yourself. I'd rather talk about the history, which we'll get to in due course, but full of the most wonderful characters that you could ever imagine. And I know just enough about them to be able to give you some decent descriptions. I look forward to doing that.
Okay, and that'll be coming up in the next of the series. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Mike.